The United States of America is bound by shared history to the continent of my birth, Africa. But much of that history has been a source of deep pain and conflict, a reality symbolized by one place in particular.
That building over there, the White House here in Washington, D.C., today occupied by an African-American president, but built in part by slaves, Africa's first natural resource to be exploited by America, its people.
But now there is something new, two significant developments which may define the United States' relationship with Africa for decades to come. The first is a legacy of the Bush administration, a brand new military command for Africa called AFRICOM. And the second is this man.
I have the blood of Africa within me. And my family's own story encompasses both the tragedies and triumphs of the larger African story.
In this two-part series, I will be traveling to the United States and through East and West Africa to investigate the U.S. strategy for this great continent. What will AFRICOM mean for Africa? And can President Obama's administration turn U.S.-African relations in a new direction?
This is the front line. This is the front line for dealing with any threats to the United States of America.
In this program, I look at the genesis of AFRICOM, ask if the US is using it to help gain access to resources, and reveal how it became involved, albeit indirectly, in its first African war. AFRICOM was officially launched on the world in October 2008.
I am confident that in the years to come, people will see an Africa that is secure, stable, and developed in ways meaningful to its people and our global society.
The new command is charged with carrying out U.S. policy in Africa and training and supporting the United States' military partners on the continent. But it was never going to be easy.
America has a lot to live down in Africa, and leaders across the continent remember only too well how the CIA wreaked havoc, helping to undermine popular governments and prop up warlords and dictators.
But for many Africans, there is something more than the United States' history which makes them suspicious of AFRICOM.
It is, at its heart, a different kind of command. The focus is on the three Ds: defense, diplomacy, and development.
The questions began immediately. Surely diplomacy and development in Africa is the work of diplomats and development workers, not soldiers.
U.S. foreign policy led by warriors, essentially, is a disastrous scenario. It's clear that you can't have warriors who are also diplomats, warriors who are also humanitarian. Those lines cannot be combined.
Yet, on one level, the creation of AFRICOM was simply a reorganization of the U.S.'s military command structure, which divided the world into five separate geographical combat commands. But there was an anomaly. Africa, that huge continent at the heart of the world, was shared between three of them. So, the creation of a new command dedicated to Africa was, in military terms at least, a logical step. But the US not only failed to sell it to Africa on that basis, they failed to consult Africa at all. Amina Saloum Ali is the African Union's ambassador in Washington.
Since this is something new and it is really great ramification in terms of the future of Africa, I think we should have expected that initially there would have been consultations between the U.S. government and African government. It was seen as this is another military imposition to African soil.
And it was that which got AFRICOM into most difficulty of all, the apparently unilateral assumption that it would build headquarters in Africa. It was an extraordinary mistake which rang alarm bells across the continent. Ambassador Hank Cohen is one of the United States' most experienced African diplomats and was the State Department's top African expert under George Bush Sr.
Well, the Africans have always believed in what the original concept of non-alignment. We do not belong to any of the great powers. It was partly anti-colonial. We got rid of the colonial powers. We don't want to have new colonial powers come in and take us over. So if Africa comes along and says, we'd like to set up a headquarters there and several sub-headquarters, they suddenly say, hey, wait a second, this bothers us. Are you trying to take us over?
And that led to a humiliating climb down for AFRICOM.
AFRICOM kind of came out like Athena from the head of Zeus, fully, fully grown and ready to go. And then it couldn't find a place to go. Couldn't find a country that it would accept its headquarters. Couldn't find anybody that wanted it.
And so, with its physical headquarters in Germany and its political masters in Washington, one of AFRICOM's first missions has been to allay the suspicion that surrounds it.
America needs to convince its critics that far from representing a militarization of its relations with the continent, AFRICOM actually represents a whole new departure based on the developmental, humanitarian, and security needs of Africans.
So why has Africa been so skeptical about AFRICOM? In Washington, I asked President Obama's top African diplomat, Ambassador Johnny Carson.
I think many Africans saw in it an effort by the U.S. To use AFRICOM to counter a Chinese presence, to be a protector of American energy and oil resources, and finally as an effort to counter rising insurgencies and terrorism.
So, what is the reality? We asked AFRICOM itself, and its commander, General Kip Ward, the highest-ranking serving African-American in the U.S. military, invited us to accompany him on a mission to Rwanda.
Well, I think the thing that we'll see here in Rwanda is an absolutely marvelous, marvelous example of how a nation has come back from the ravages of the genocide. It has created a professional military, a disciplined force, that is also very much understanding of the role that it can play in trying to bring stability and security to the region.
The next day, in honor of the general, the Rwandan Defense Force demonstrates its military mettle. And beside him throughout, although not on this occasion talking to the press, is the US ambassador to Rwanda, Stuart Symington. Now, officially, of course, ambassadors working for the US State Department are the focus and conduit for the United States' diplomatic relations with the rest of the world. So the question is, who's really in the lead here? The diplomat or the soldier? The State Department or the Pentagon?
There are a lot of fears that there's too much of an emphasis on the militarization of the relationship between the United States and African countries, such as Rwanda.
This is only one small portion of the totality of our relationship. Now, when you talk about development, diplomacy, defense, they all have to exist. And the fact that we do a small portion of it then enables these other things to occur.
It's perhaps not surprising that General Ward is so anxious to stress the partnership between diplomacy and defense, because, in part at least, AFRICOM is a direct product of the fraught relationship between those two competing wings of the US government. To understand that, we have to travel back to the beginning of the millennium, to a battle fought not in the African bush, but the corridors of power in Washington. AFRICOM is, in part at least, the product of a bitter turf war which defined the early years of the Bush administration, a war fought between the US State Department, which officially runs the United States International Relations, and the Department of Defense in the Pentagon.
The soldiers won that struggle. And under Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, the Pentagon drove American foreign, military, and development policy across the world.
Larry Wilkerson, a career soldier, became Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff under George Bush.
To find a voice that equals or exceeds the voice of the Pentagon is virtually impossible. How do you put $30 billion chump change up against $0.75 trillion? That $0.75 trillion attracts to it every congressman, every senator, every major military contractor from Halliburton to Lockheed. You have an enormous constituency for war. You have an enormous constituency for the instruments of war. What constituency in America does the State Department have? None. Zero.
So the Bush years were defined by the ascendancy of the Pentagon and its neoconservative cheerleaders. But what was their agenda, and how did it lead to the creation of AFRICOM? One clue to that is to be found behind the windows of an office in Washington known as the Old Executive Building.
As soon as President George W. Bush was installed in the White House just round the corner, his vice president, Dick Cheney, came to this building behind me to convene a series of secret meetings with oil company executives.
That was so closely guarded that even people, I'm not even sure my boss, Secretary Powell, knew exactly what kind of conversations took place there. Here's what my educated surmise is, that among other things, they discussed tipping points, they discussed the scarcity, growing scarcity of non-renewable fossil fuels. I think out of that came this concept, strategic concept, that we better be doing something to get our hands on or get control of or influence over a substantial amount of oil in the world so that we can ensure our economic future. Indeed, ensure the American way of life.
It became known as the Energy Security Panic and was to define the foreign policy initiatives of the Bush administration. But then, something happened which added a whole new urgency to the debate.
Boom!
The horrifying attack on the Twin Towers in 2001 brought death to the United States on a scale familiar elsewhere, but utterly new to the US. And what President Bush called the Global War on Terror was born. A war on an ill-defined international conspiracy of jihadists, mostly operating under the Al-Qaeda label. That war formed a critical mass with the US's oil security fears. And suddenly, Africa, a continent which had been increasingly slipping off the Americans' radar, began to look more important.
Dick Cheney saw America's war as a war with Islam. And subsequently, we were going to have difficult relationships with countries in the Middle East that were supplying an enormous amount of our oil. So President Bush, after 9/11, announced that we needed to get 75% of the oil that we were getting from the Middle East from Africa.
Did it represent a significant shift in American foreign policy?
It created an interest in Africa that had not been there before.
And with China and even Russia increasingly active in the continent, Africa began to exercise some of the most influential right-wing thinkers of the time.
The Heritage Foundation, housed in this imposing-looking building behind me, is arguably the foremost conservative think tank in American politics, and it was the intellectual powerhouse behind the Bush administration. In October 2003, they produced this document, U.S. Military Assistance for Africa. In it, it argues for increased efforts to coordinate security measures with African countries at risk from terrorism. And the best way to do that, they argued, was for the creation of a dedicated military command for Africa. In essence, they were arguing for AFRICOM.
And they were clear why that was needed. Africa has
vast natural and mineral resources.
And, said the report,
America must not be afraid to employ its forces decisively when vital national interests are threatened.
But where does that stand with the rhetoric of stability, freedom and partnership, which is AFRICOM's professed purpose?
What was the motivation for Iraq and the invasion in March of 2003 as opposed to the rhetoric, if not the same thing? Democracy, freedom. What were we really in Iraq for? It's clear to me what we're in Iraq for. I worked in the Pentagon as assistant to Chairman Powell when he was working for Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney. He is the ultimate realpolitiker. He is the ultimate realist with a hyper-nationalist twist. Dick Cheney did not go to Iraq to end terrorism. Dick Cheney went to Iraq to gain access to the second largest known oil reserves in the world.
But that was then, of course, and this is now. A new dawn, a new administration, and a president whose own roots lie as deeply in Africa as in the United States of America. So will AFRICOM be different under Obama? Can the US overcome its past mistakes in this continent? Well, perhaps there is a lesson in Rwanda, because today Rwanda and the US have one of the closest military and diplomatic alliances on the continent. And not that long ago, that would have seemed impossible. On April the 7th, 1994, Africa's first genocide of the 20th century began. In the space of just 100 days, one-seventh of the population of Rwanda, mostly Tutsis and moderate Hutus, were massacred. As many as 1 million people died. In the grounds of this church alone, around 5,000 people sought sanctuary. They all perished, men, women and children, hacked and clubbed to death in a terrifying frenzy of violence. Today, their clothes and bones lie here in remembrance.
At the time of the genocide, I was 14 years old.
You're 14.
Eugenie, a Tutsi from the capital Kigali, watched her family die.
So, as we Tutsis, also we tried to hide. So we use the schools, we use the churches, we use the bushes so that we can have protection.
And what happened to your family during the genocide?
I lost my two parents, four sisters and one brother. I saw with my eyes killing my mother.
Mm.
Yeah.
Imagine.
I'm with her when they killed them at the time.
So sorry.
It's how it is.
For 3 months, the killings continued, and despite desperate pleas for help, the UN, the West, and most prominently the self-proclaimed leader of the free world, the United States, failed to act. They even refused to call it genocide.
It really isn't going too far to say that had the United States government intervened during the genocide in Rwanda, the tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of people who died under the most horrific circumstances would still be alive today.
Basically, I think they were indifferent. There is the cynical side. What are we getting out of that country anyway? What does it produce? It's a tiny country with a lot of poor people who are hacking each other. I think since there's no resources in there, there's nothing really worth fighting for, dying for. If some of the troops have to die, then why not leave it, you know, simmer itself out and perhaps hope for the best.
But it didn't simmer out. In the end, the genocide was effectively brought to an end by the Rwanda Patriotic Front, a rebel force consisting largely of young Tutsi men and women who had themselves been refugees from earlier ethnic violence. Today, those rebels have become the official army of Rwanda. But despite the US's inaction during the genocide, they are now bound to the US in one of the closest military alliances on the continent. The question is why?
Ladies and gentlemen, General Ward.
Well, this is where a curious difference in presentation arises. The Americans are keen to stress the buzzwords, partnership, and the need to build stability and security in the area.
We indeed are a committed partner, doing things that will help promote stability and security in the region, on the continent, and by so doing, that stability is felt around the world.
The Rwandans are more up front. They have no illusions about why the United States wants to be their friend.
We are not naive to believe that the United States doesn't have economic interests in the region. Rwanda does not have a lot to offer in terms of economic incentives, but Rwanda has a lot to offer in terms of its position in this area.
So it's a deal. Rwanda gets help and military training from AFRICOM, and the US gets a loyal ally in a country whose neighbors, most notably the Congo, are dangerously unstable, but rich in the resources and minerals which the United States of America needs.
One way of looking at this is that in 94, at the height of the genocide, America had no interest in Rwanda, and therefore it didn't act. Now, America does have economic interests and security interests, and now it's a friend of Rwanda.
And that's the way the world works. I think that you cannot dwell too much on the past if there are, you know, strategic interests for both partners. America also might be killing two birds with one stone by appearing to its citizens to be caring about Rwanda, while at the same time they are taking care of their strategic interests, such as the minerals and in the neighborhood and so on.
The problem is, African armies can have agendas. The US is training and supporting an army which is integral to the ruling Tutsi-dominated party of Rwanda. It is a party which has made considerable progress in terms of truth and reconciliation and development. But press freedom is restricted. There are serious questions about the conduct of the 2003 elections. And opposition figures can find themselves removed, arrested, or accused of fostering divisionism or genocide ideology. So should the US be training this government's army?
There are many armies in Africa that have been associated with national liberation struggles. And it is important that those armies evolve from guerrilla armies into professional armies, subservient to civilian, constitutional, and democratic authority, just as it is in the United States.
But in Rwanda, the army serves a government accused of undermining democracy. So where does that leave AFRICOM and US policy? Djibouti is a very small country in a very important strategic position. For a start, it provides a route to the sea for its huge landlocked neighbour Ethiopia, a demanding and uncomfortable journey through a dry and inhospitable landscape. But Ethiopia is not the only foreign country interested in Djibouti.
One of my Marine colleagues said, "My God, if they put another single soldier Marine on Djibouti, it'll sink."
Because in some ways, Djibouti is the AFRICOM headquarters that never was. It began as a naval expeditionary camp in 2003 as part of the global war on terror. Its position at the heart of the Horn of Africa could not be more strategic, with Somalia, Ethiopia and Sudan on the African side, and across the water, the Middle East. But since 2007, it has grown significantly in size, expanding from 88 acres to nearly 500. It is now the US's largest permanent camp in Africa. From these offices, CJT HOA, as it's known, the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa, carries out AFRICOM's mission in this entire area of Africa.
Well, the initial mission of the Combined Joint Task Force was very counterterrorism focused, and went from that very direct approach at countering terrorism to what we have today, to is a very indirect approach to countering violent extremism.
In a village outside Djibouti town, an example of this indirect approach, where American military construction specialists known as Seabees were rebuilding a school roof. As an exercise in winning hearts and minds, it was undoubtedly successful.
Qu'est-ce que vous pensez à les soldats américains? Merci, merci beaucoup.
Education, health, development are all convincingly a part of Camp Le Monnier's mission. But this is a military operation, and key to that is military-to-military training.
You make a difference.
But of course, that can be very politically sensitive.
Now, most of these militaries are attempting to cause their security structures to be seen as structures that protect their people as opposed to oppress their people. And so that requires a degree of continued professionalization of their military forces.
The difficulty for General Ward and his command is that they cannot control what those armies then do with that training.
See, here's the question. When AFRICOM talks about we are stabilizing countries across the continent, who exactly are they stabilizing? Are they stabilizing the government that's in power? Is the government in power representative of the interests of the people? And the answer across the continent, most people on the ground will tell you, is absolutely not.
These leaders are assuming, really, that by building up their militaries, they will be able to sustain their power and sustain their regimes. This is not necessarily something that's in the best interest of the people, right? And it's often really that, you know, democracy is the first target, the first victim, and innocent civilians follow.
Indeed, in 2008 in Mauritania, the army, which had received U.S. training, went on to overthrow the democratically elected president and take power itself.
While you cite examples of where it has not gone right, there are many where it has gone correctly, whereby the military has stayed apolitical, has been seen as protectors of its people, and I think that too is something that ought to be understood.
So which armies have stayed apolitical, as General Ward puts it? It's actually surprisingly difficult to say. You'd be hard-pushed to describe the Rwandan army as apolitical. Disciplined and brave, certainly, but still fiercely loyal to the government and party it put in power by force in 1994. And that also applies to another of the neighboring countries with which the US has established close relations. 1,500 kilometers to the southwest of Djibouti, Uganda. A relationship which raises some of the most difficult questions about AFRICOM's whole mission. Uganda has been ruled for nearly a quarter of a century by one party under President Yoweri Museveni. He and his rebel force, the National Resistance Army, seized power in 1986, ending decades of terror under the despotic regimes of Idi Amin and Milton Obote. But today, there are growing concerns about Museveni's increasingly autocratic rule and growing restrictions on political freedom. In 2008, Museveni provoked international condemnation by changing the constitution so he could stand indefinitely for president. In July 2009, US President Obama spoke for the first time in sub-Saharan Africa.
And make no mistake, history is on the side of these brave Africans. Not with those who use coups or change constitutions to stay in power. Africa doesn't need strong men. It needs strong institutions.
Despite these fine words, the US continues to train and work closely with Museveni's army, Ugandan People's Defense Force. Major Felix Kulaija is the UPDF spokesman.
They have helped us in building capability to build the peace and the stability in this country. Now, once you build that local capacity, then the local military is transformed, like ours, which has a guerrilla background, to a professional military that is indeed neutral, but not apolitical. So that's where the difference, where we parted with other people.
So while General Ward insists that the armies they work with should remain apolitical, the spokesman for the UPDF insists their army is indeed political. In effect, openly and proudly, an arm of Museveni's ruling party, the National Resistance Movement.
This is a partisan army, an army that supports only the president and actually does not see itself as a separate arm of the state from the executive. It is organized and run in a manner as to protect the regime. And they believe that with the support of a powerful country like America, they can live much longer than if they didn't have this support. And of course, America, they also believe that these regimes are fairly vulnerable without the military, without the coercive arms of the state. So there is that mutuality of interest as far as the regimes are concerned.
So with both its critics and its supporters describing the UPDF as a political army loyal to one political party, you might expect the US to be very wary of any involvement. Yet it was with the UPDF that AFRICOM first became involved, albeit indirectly, in a full-on combat operation, a conflict with a complex history. For more than 20 years, northern Uganda has endured a terrible war, waged by a rebel force called the Lord's Resistance Army, under the command of a dangerous mystic called Joseph Coyne. Since 1987, the LRA has abducted thousands of children, forcing them to join their ranks and terrorize their own communities with acts of unspeakable brutality and torture, commonly cutting off the hands, lips, noses, and ears of their victims. No one knows how many have died, but millions were displaced into huge and dangerous camps, which were themselves often attacked. There is no doubt that the LRA, part cult, part ruthless army, is a very difficult enemy, and the UPDF, often accused itself of acts of barbarity and repression, has failed over 20 years to end the insurrection. Indeed, the last two major military drives against the LRA had catastrophic consequences, dispersing them across the country and seriously escalating the violence.
This one, we're trying to escape with.
But northern Uganda was seen as an area with few resources and little strategic value, and for years the world seemed hardly to notice the suffering of the people, until recently. The United States has become much more interested, and some suggest the reason for that interest was not as honorable as it may seem.
American interest in helping Uganda deal with the Lord's Resistance Army is very recent, and it has everything to do with the situation in Sudan, particularly southern Sudan.
This part of Africa is an area of complex and interconnected struggles. Uganda's neighbor to the north is Sudan, and for over 20 years, that country too had been riven by civil war. But the war in Sudan ended in 2005. For the time being, the peace is holding, and that has led to renewed interest in the region because Sudan has oil.
Following the end of the war in Sudan, it became clear that it was now possible in peace to exploit the resources in southern Sudan, particularly oil. So, anybody disturbing the peace between Uganda and Sudan was a problem to that project. And therefore, it became necessary to ensure that the LRA was stopped.
And now, to create even more interest in the area, significant amounts of oil have been found in Uganda itself. I decided to put a blunt proposition to Uganda's Minister for International Affairs, Henry Oryema Kello.
The Americans are very keen on dismantling the LRA because of the threat to the economic interests in this region, oil and minerals.
Possibly. Possibly.
Probably.
Probably. Why not? We're very satisfied with that relationship, but no doubt that there are people within the hierarchy or within the government who are suspicious that, yes, the Americans are here not to help us out of the situation, but to make sure they protect the developing oil fields that are emerging in this region.
And the LRA would have disrupted that. I mean, it could have threatened those interests.
If the LRA were left to own devices, the LRA could cause a regional disaster in this region. And that, if it had happened, it would have disrupted, as you said, the interests of many parties.
And as the interests of those other parties grew, things did change dramatically.
2008 was when AFRICOM became embroiled, albeit indirectly, in its first war. After 22 years of brutal war, northern Uganda saw its first real hope of peace in 2007. Delegates representing the Lord's Resistance Army, which was hiding in the Garamba forests on the Congo-Sudan border, had been involved in protracted peace negotiations in southern Sudan, mediated by southern Sudanese Vice President Riek Machar. And the first stage had been reached. A peace agreement had been signed by the LRA delegation. Progress was painfully slow. LRA leader Joseph Coyne failed on several occasions to turn up and sign the final agreement, and sporadic attacks by the LRA continued, mostly on isolated villages in southern Sudan and the DRC. But still, the relative peace held, along with it, the hope that there could be an alternative to the awful prospect of a renewed military offensive against an army consisting largely of kidnapped children and young people. In Uganda, many people returned home for the first time in decades. People began growing crops. But it was not to last. On December the 14th, 2008, the UPDF launched a massive surprise assault on the LRA in the Congo. It was codenamed Operation Lightning Thunder and saw helicopter gunship bombardments of LRA camps, followed by an assault by ground troops in the remote, heavily forested lands on the borders of Congo, Sudan, and the Central African Republic. The peace was over. Officially, this was a joint operation supported by the governments of Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Southern Sudan. It was also supported by the United States through AFRICOM. How did the Americans support you in Operation Lightning Thunder?
The Americans provided fuel. It indeed was an expensive venture. So that we are able to fly in logistical support. We are able to hobnob troops and insert them where they would be tactically necessary.
Did they help you with information?
Yes,
intelligence?
But they did, particularly with the satellite imagery. They also helped, I think, with providing us with the telecommunication capability.
But if the one overarching aim of Operation Lightning Thunder was to kill Joseph Coyne, it was a failure. He escaped, some say, with minutes to spare. According to the UPDF figures, by the end of the three-month-long operation, a total of 300 abductees were rescued and 150 rebels were killed, most from the air assaults. Many of these, inevitably, were children. In the official parlance of this war, the dead are always described as rebels. Those taken alive are described as rescued abductees. Officially, 12 UPDF soldiers died, although some estimates have put that figure much higher. Coyne's camps were bombed and his forces scattered. But the collateral damage in southern Sudan and the DRC has been enormous. Since the beginning of Operation Lightning Thunder, the LRA has killed more than 1,000 civilians in revenge attacks and displaced over 500,000 people.
When they came in their village, they were looting them and burning their houses, abducting some of them or cutting their ears and the parts of their body.
These villagers in southern Sudan were forced to flee their homes as a result of the operation.
They're really persevering a heavy hunger. There's no food.
Without food and proper accommodation, some of these children are becoming seriously malnourished. And all of this raises some very difficult questions indeed for the US. Because some evidence suggests that the United States didn't just help with Operation Lightning Thunder, it may actually have been responsible for making it happen. The operation, which lasted for several months and perhaps longer, was officially announced as a joint operation sanctioned by President Salva Kiir of southern Sudan, President Kabila of the DRC, and President Museveni of Uganda.
The President Museveni had lots of consultations with his friend Salva Kiir, who came on board definitely because the LRA were a threat to him just as much as LRA is a threat to Uganda. Then the President worked tirelessly to bring Kabila on board and accept that Kabila should also be a party to this tripartite effort to deal with the LRA.
Yet in an exclusive interview, Riek Machar, vice president of the South Sudanese government, supposedly a full partner in Lightning Thunder, told us that the governments were pressurized into the operation by the outgoing Bush administration in the United States.
I know the Ugandans were under pressure from the last going administration. And I also know that President Kabila was under pressure. We resisted. We didn't want to get into the operations. We discussed it. We described it that it's like disturbing a beehive. And once you destroy the beehive, the bees hit indiscriminately. And this is what happened in the Congo.
According to Machar, the South Sudanese were so unhappy with the plan, they limited their support to a tightening of their borders to stop further LRA incursions from Garamba in the Congo into Sudan.
We decided to close our borders. That's all we did. We did not want to get involved in the fight. We have the background of a guerrilla fighters, all of us, from my president to myself and to our army. We know what it takes to fight a guerrilla force with conventional means in a thick forest.
So where did the American pressure for the operations come from? George Bush's main African policy advisor at that time was Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, Gendai Fraser.
Who was pushing from America for Operation Lightning Thunder?
Gendai.
Gendai Fraser.
Yeah, Gendai was the chief.
We asked Dr. Fraser for her response to Machar's claim. She said that Museveni, Kabila, and Kiir of southern Sudan had
ongoing discussions of a military offensive against the LRA, independent of any US prompting.
She added,
there was no pressure coming from me for such an operation. By that time, there was broad consensus that Dr. Machar's efforts to negotiate with the LRA had failed to convince Joseph Coyne to leave the bush.
Dr. Fraser's replacement in the Obama administration is Ambassador Johnny Carson.
We've been told by our sources that, and it was quite clear, that the United States authorities at that time were involved in Operation Lightning Thunder and, in fact, pushed for it.
Well, I don't know whether that's the case. I would don't want to comment on what others were engaged in doing.
Was Lightning Thunder a success?
It was. I think the LRA now do not have the capacity to cause the kind of mayhem that it used to do, not only in Uganda, but even in the DRC.
Lightning Thunder, I think that was a big mistake. The warriors have had their chance. Maybe let the peacemakers come back to resolve this now.
The problem is, it may now be too late to resurrect the peace process in Uganda. But the fact remains that the US, in an attempt to position itself for the future, was involved in and possibly instigated a conflict with devastating consequences, including the deaths of many children. And of course, this desperate situation is only one aspect of the Bush administration's legacy for AFRICOM and its future direction.
AFRICOM faces a huge dilemma. The Bush administration had an agenda for Africa which may well have best been served by a combat military command. But if Obama's agenda is truly different, then is a combat command really the best mechanism for implementing it?
Policy decisions are made by the President of the United States, by our Secretary of State, by our Congress. And so the command makes no policies. We implement the stated foreign policy objectives of our nation.
In the next program, I ask whether President Bush's so-called war on terror actually created the threat it claimed to be fighting in Somalia, and whether AFRICOM is in danger of repeating those mistakes in the Sahel. And finally, I ask whether Obama and the United States are really prepared to turn their backs on the African strongmen who control so much of Africa's oil.